Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
But yeah, no, you can say whatever you like. In fact, you can be obscene. You can do a call to action. This is not
radio.
Yes,
it's not radio.
There's
but try to limit the number of times you say shit encrusted anal sphincter.
Pete is going to make up
that's
for lost time.
That's where I draw the line. That's where I draw the line.
I don't want to be the person who finds out what that actually looks like.
Oh, I got to kill my Altoid.
No, keep the Altoid going, man. I think people can sense the minty fresh breath through the podcast. It's a karma thing.
So, who do you think is the punchiest right now of the three of us?
I got up at 3:30 in the morning and came in to work on an NSF thing, but I did chug a Red Bull, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Okay, that's you. Tony, when do you normally get up?
Usually about 7:30 or 8 o'clock or so, and then it's a good 30 minutes before I actually am capable. So you're catching me right at the cusp of the transition.
That's a big coffee you got. Okay.
Oh, this is number two.
There it is.
And soon right. It'll be number
Charlie's
two.
Charlie's not actually here. The part of Charlie will be played by a wax standard.
My mind is elsewhere. There are twins coming.
Oh, congratulations.
Is that a Johnny There are a twins coming. They're coming around the band.
The due date, which is sort of a scheduled day at this point, is a week from today.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations. So what's it like when you get the Costco report that you're having pregnancy in bulk?
I have joked That's in good. The past that when something happens, you know, it was like I'd been hit by a hammer or like hit in the head with a shovel or something like that. It finally happened in that doctor's office. The blood drained out of my face. I was just sitting there looking at the doctor, and my wife and the doctor were talking about, are those, oh my God, those twins. And is that, was are they identical? Are they fraternal? And I was just thinking, Oh, shit. Oh, what? Oh, shit. That's it. Like, for 10 minutes.
I imagine it's like being caught with your pants down. Like, you want to respond. It's like, oh, you're having a beautiful baby, but now there's two of them. And then all course of questioning that you originally expected out the window.
The doctor kept saying, this is so exciting. This is so great. And I kept thinking, I didn't know.
Meanwhile, all the fluid's seeping out of you, and you're just flat on the floor, and everybody's like, well, where's Charlie?
My levels were right here, man.
And then you put a dipstick down your throat just to check. You should talk to Lou Lefton in math, though, because Lou has twins.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
And he says that twins is kind of a weird relationship. They sort of speak their own language when they're younger, but then as years go by, they'll learn more common ways to communicate, like Java.
An X.
Python.
With our,
you have a full stack developer between the two twins.
Our daughter is, I hope, going to bring along the language, you know, because we're not starting with twins. This is our second child and our third. So, you know, Lila Jane should be able to socialize them a little bit as opposed to.
But your children will have similarly literary arcane names, right?
Yeah.
Lila Jane sounds like something, you know, like the character from To Kill a Mockingbird that got cut out.
I'm going to have to cut all this out. June.
He always says it. Never happens.
It's funny that you said To Kill a Mockingbird, too, because our kids, our twins are going to be Juniper and Atticus.
Right.
And for sure, I'm going to call Atticus Finch at some point in his life. And Juniper, of course, Junebug.
But it sounds like, who's the author from, was it Mississippi?
Harper Lee.
No, not Harper Lee.
John Grisham?
No.
Faulkner.
Older. Faulkner. Sounds like something out of a Faulkner.
Older than Grisham.
Come here, June bug. Get daddy another beer.
That is so not how Faulkner talked. Faulkner was a Southern Fitzgerald. He was trying to be something he was not.
So he's more come here, June bug. Get me another mint julep.
Pete, don't ever go to Mississippi.
I've been to Mississippi. Mississippi is actually a very nice place. It is much more intellectual and airy. I was at University of Mississippi, actually.
Where is that?
It's Oxford, isn't it? Oxford, Mississippi.
So you were at Ole Miss.
I was at Ole Miss.
Yeah.
Is that what they call it, Ole Miss?
Yeah.
And there's this little plot of land where So the genteel people wear seersucker suits before the sporting event. They sit around there.
I would like to make it clear the reason I'm telling you not to go to Mississippi is because you have a very strange vision of it.
No, I visited the School of Chemistry, the chemistry department. They're doing great stuff. Very capable.
I took a visit to the cultural epicenter of Western Mississippi. It was exit something that I never want to stop at again.
Exit something.
But, exit something off of 20, exit something off of 78.
So we were driving from Austin to New Orleans, and we crossed over the border and hit this ridiculous storm. There's a lot of water nearby there, so
yeah.
Pretty strong storm. And then we cruised about 50 miles or so, and we went to stop off, and we pulled off at the Tiger gas station. And when we parked the car, we, like, looked above the car, and it was this really weird sort of exodus moment because all the bugs above it were just hitting the light and just falling down and dying. And everything felt wrong about this place. So we pump up our gas, and we got these good old boys down the way looking at us kind of weird. And we go inside, and I'm sitting at the register for a good 5-10 minutes. And people are coming through, and they will not serve me. They were just ignoring me straight up and down. But during this 5 minutes, I got a good look around. The owner of Tiger Gas Station owns a tiger named Tony.
No.
And he is raging a very long campaign on how exotic animals and their owners are treated in Western Mississippi. And he wants you to notify your local legislation. Now, let me tell you, we got out of there real fast. And then we went to the place around the corner. There was a trough in the bathroom, and there were way more knives than I felt comfortable with right next to the bubble gum.
Like knives for sale?
Knives for sale, man. $30 for a knife about this big. It seems like a one-time use.
That was about a 1 meter indication there. It's, it's more of a machete.
So we've totally buried the lead. Who's this guy that's talking to us who's not on the name of the podcast? What's up, Tony?
Hey, Charlie.
Dr. Fast.
How are you?
I'm well. Nice to talk to you again. You've been on my show, Lost in the Stacks, and also I hear that you were in this room recently trying to navigate a facilitated conversation.
And Tony and I have the same parole officer, so it's good to know.
Yeah, that guy is so overworked.
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah. so that's a good sign.
So I got to start with, what's it like to have a name like Tony Fast? It sounds like some action movie hero in a world where one man, Tony Fast, will kick your ass. It just sounds good.
So I know that I still have friends who assume that Fast is still a punk rock nickname that I've grown up with my whole life.
Right.
There are people who still don't really know that that's actually my real name. But in science, it's actually done me a terrible disservice.
Why's that?
Because I write out some of my research is on fast algorithms to do stuff.
Your Google searches are all screwed up?
Google searches are terrible, and Tony Fast is a SpongeBob character.
Wait, so, is he? I watch that cartoon all the time.
Yeah, he's one of the extra characters.
And you don't have kids?
I don't have kids. I have two little puppies. If I do that well with children, I don't know how long they'll make it.
SpongeBob. I remember being in the classroom. It was a class on Moby Dick, and the end of the class, the sort of, hey, free time kind of thing, they sang a sea shanty, and then they sang the SpongeBob SquarePants theme song. And I don't think that they prepared the SpongeBob SpongeBob SquarePants theme song. This whole class just ripped it right on the day. They did not have to even blink. And I thought, oh, the cultural currency, I don't understand it at all anymore. It's like when there's a kid who starts all her emails, hola. And it took me maybe 6 months to realize.
Dora the Explorer.
Dora the Explorer.
But did they sing it in the voice of Mr. Krabs with the... Oh, who lives in a pineapple under the sea? That kind of thing? Or was it just the lyrics?
See, Pete's got the kid.
I don't think many children have the same weathered tone to their voice that Pete does, though. No, but the phenomenon of the Frozen song. I went to the Stone Mountain Laser Light Show recently.
Oh, was Let It Go
in
there?
Oh, and they had the music from Frozen on it?
Yeah, and it's like you're in a huge opera, because all of the children are just singing it. Everybody knows.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody wants to be that princess.
For Halloween, there were a lot of them. Well, we don't want to put any gender stereotypes on people. I haven't seen the film yet, either. I have no intention of seeing it either.
I got no problem with gender stereotype. I mean, I don't mean, I'm not engaged with the gender stereotypes. What I just want is for no more consumerism driving what our kids think of themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, just if you know, we have a playhouse in the back of our yard and a fire pit and a tree platform.
Where Charlie goes for clandestine drinking when his wife's mad at him.
It's not big enough. But, like, that's what I'm cool with Lila Jane going out there and playing with. And I just don't want her to... I don't even have a full thought for that because I'm scared of it.
There's several years back, the University of the Arts in Philadelphia was hosting a lecture series. And this woman from MICA, the Maryland Institute of Contemporary Arts, was there. She's giving a talk. Her name was Ellen Lupton. She was talking about a book.
Oh, she writes the books about books.
DIY Kids.
Yeah, indie
so that would be
a
meta book?
Well, no, I mean, she writes books about how to make your own books and how to do... Yeah, she's awesome.
Branding for children. The idea is that you create your own brand. She kind of helps you with the fundamentals of design to create something that's yours.
Right.
And then you create products around your own brand or your own idea to kind of remove that sort of element of hero worship.
And, like, as a parent, your own brand, or just as a person, your own brand, so it's more like community, which was the sort of direction she was coming from.
Yeah. It's a lot more localized.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I recently moved to the suburbs and right. Tucker, right, which is pretty self-contained and is sort of a classic suburb. And I've really been feeling the pull to go and just connect with what's going on there in the very, it's not a bubble, because, I mean, Tucker's not like, I'm not going to compare it to some other suburb, but Tucker is not some isolated bedroom community, you know, 6 hours out of a city.
I don't know what that means, bedroom community. What does that mean?
I think
bedroom, a lot of action going on?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a John Updike novel.
Pillow fights everywhere. Number one crime.
That sounds good.
A bedroom community is a community where mostly people just end up there at the end of the day to sleep. If you were a New York worker and you lived in New Jersey, say 2 hours away by train, pretty much the only time you spent in your house was when you were in your bedroom. And I think that's why it's a bedroom community.
Gotcha.
I could be completely wrong. Well, what did you think?
We're going to go with that theory.
Ellen Lupton's, did that apply to you?
It applied to you and what you just mentioned. I mean, I think it was just a really nice idea for children to worship what they make. I think that there's a big...
Their
towards
own
telling
stuff.
People not to do stuff and why, answering the questions why. But I think that this book offers a reason as why not. You know, I think that there's sort of an intrinsic value in just seeing what you're capable of making yourself. And that's a good message to send to children very early on, because it's really hard to be happy, I think. You know, I mean, it's like, even as a grown up, it's really hard not to want stuff all the time. You know, I mean, you're constantly given that. But, like, if you can start out with a baseline that I can make what I want, that must be an empowering idea.
All right. Off mic, we were talking a little bit about general dissatisfaction with the state of our professions. Are you trying to make something that you can be proud of?
I always make stuff I'm proud of. It's just that I'm proud of it. But by the time that I present it to other people and they take it, it's not the pride that goes away. It's just a little bit upset that I shared it with somebody who didn't care. I think that the thing that there's a really wholesome critiquing process that artists are exposed to, but scientists aren't. And they have really terrible egos and personalities. And not
Pete,
I'd
like to explore that.
But some of them in a good way and some of them in a bad way. You know, I mean, it just is a characteristic. Yeah. And
I like
it,
to
is a
think
trait.
If you do science well, or engineering, applied science, you have critique. Some of my colleagues don't believe in that. A gentleman I know was involved in the Grand Challenges freshman program, and the freshmen, they come in and they plan this solution to a big problem, Grand Challenges, but they're freshmen. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to forget about things. So when they present it, you acknowledge what they've done well. Okay, that's good. But you say, have you thought about, you know, the economic ramifications or the environmental ramifications? Think about that. That's our job. We teach. Not go, you forgot about that, you idiot. That's not a good way to do things. We talked about this before. There's criticism and there's critique. Mm-hmm. Critique is structured. It's useful. It's constructive. I believe that if someone gives you a critique and it's all good or all bad, it's usually a load of crap. You got to get both in. And it might be predominantly good or predominantly bad, but if you can't say one good thing about, well, okay, you can be a total idiot. Like that waiter I had at Tony Roma's who was not properly trained out in L.A. I actually walked up to his boss. And I'm the kind of guy who, when I'm in a restaurant, if I get good service, I will call the manager over, point to this person, and I said, look, this was the best waiter waitress we've ever had. This person deserves a raise. They're absolutely fabulous. But this guy,
that's how waiters and waitresses get raises.
Well, they don't. But the point is, we always complain. We never say when something's good.
Everybody
right?
wants to know when they're doing a good job.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that that general atmosphere doesn't exist in academia right now. I mean, when you look at how a lot of the reward,
I will concur with that one.
When you look at the reward processes for these really smart and creative younger students who are coming through right now,
They're depressed.
They're depressed. They're depressed. There's a really big disconnect between their everyday life and their scientific life. And I really think that there's a lot of students who believe that their scientific life can be just like their real life, but there are some external forces sort of, you know, trying to contain that and control it. It's not going to last very long. I really think that the floodgates have a potential to open very soon.
So now you've made two comparisons or contrasted two things. The critique system built into art with the absence of critique system in science, and then a sort of, to summarize it, you know, there's this praise system that's not present, that might be present in the rest of the world. Are you feeling an ivory tower thing? Just to go all the way back to our very first episode, we said, you know, people describe the real world and then they describe academia, and we kind of bucked at that particular comparison, but it sounds maybe like you're feeling like the real world needs to get into academia, like there's a boundary.
I don't ever think it's a single solution, right? I mean, there's a responsibility that scientists have to the public, and there's a general curiosity that the public has to science. And I think that the interface between them stinks. It's almost non-existent, yeah. Right?
I mean, and when you think interface, what are you thinking of?
So how do we as scientists publish? We write research papers. The latency of knowledge transfer to the public of a public good is irresponsible, in my opinion.
And when you say public good, because it's publicly funded?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're doing work. I mean, in my space of material science, our whole goal is to make new and improved materials to help society move along. We're trying to fill needs and gaps in our set of tools as humans to make society better. But we're worried about questions about how individual atoms interact, or was this line of code in a simulation right or wrong? But I mean, we've really lost sight of what the whole application of the work is, and that's to help people and make things better.
And I think the average person is not aware of the materials revolution that started decades ago, that much of what has advanced in engineering in the last several decades is due to advanced materials, right?
I feel like we're talking about batteries at this point.
No, we're talking about batteries. We're talking about the microprocessor in your cell phone. The people that are most aware, the people that have a pretty good interface, are people that use materials. So I would say artists, carpenters, some construction people who understand how new materials work, right? I mean, you have both natural and synthetic stone materials for, you know, if you do kitchens, you're much more aware of the modern revolution materials, because there is stuff that you can buy that costs a quarter of what granite costs that are these artificial materials. Decking. If you've rebuilt a deck recently, you have now all these choices. You have wood. You've had wood that's been chemically treated to have certain properties. And then you have this artificial stuff. And you can choose what is the right material for you.
So I just bought a house. That's how I moved to Tucker. And
you bought the house and then they carried you to Tucker in it? Was that part of the deal?
I bought the house and I thought it would come to me, but then the tentacles came out and it was like, you know, it was like the end of Of Hellboy, man.
It's the friggin' small print, right?
Hellboy.
Small print. It's the runes at the end. Anyway, when you buy a house, you be careful, man. It'll come for you. No, so I moved to Tucker, and my house, you know, a house is a system, right? And it's full of more systems,
it
and
is.
You have to deal with those, and systems break down, especially right. systems that put water next to wood,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. I have one of those now.
And so I have been learning, like, just the material. Okay, on Lost in the Stacks, the one and only Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show, Fridays at noon on WREK.
Booyah.
91.1, also podcasted. Google it.
Is it on the box, the back of a cereal box by now, too?
It's just burnt into my brain.
Okay.
So we talk about the material oomph, and that's kind of our joke way of saying the pleasure that one takes from the materiality of information, you know, the actual opening up of a book or going into a box to get something or having to deal with the media that is not invisible, right? And that was very academic in a way. It was also like, oh, cool, a record. Hey, man, this book is like, you know, 3 centuries old. It's great. But now, after a year in the house, I'm starting very much to feel that the materiality of your problems is as important as the materiality of your joys, right? Because, like, I chopped wood this weekend. Took me 3 hours to do the whole process, and I had a chainsaw. And I chopped wood, I think, for about 6 hours of a fire, which of course made me think I would be dead in the 1800s. There's just no way.
Right.
I thought how soft I had gotten and how disconnected from the reality of what I was doing. I can appreciate what you're saying, Tony, when you say, you know, that we're trying to make things better, these new materials, but I have so little knowledge of that. I'm just starting to realize how little knowledge I have, which is a good start, but I just don't, I almost never think about how this, somebody designed the materials in this. This is not a piece of wood that someone cut and then slapped plastic on. Like, people thought about how this all works together. Everything in this and that right there.
He's groping the urethane foam.
And
cover.
I bet you right now some people are a little bit like, this podcast sucks, you know, because those noises, you don't expect those in what we're doing now, right? This is a very, what did McLuhan say, cool medium?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And making it hot by talking about material. That's it. That's all I got. I'm done.
Well, I mean, so we wander around in a material world, right? I think you guys played.
Because we are material girls.
I think that's what played when I did the Lost in the Stacks
episode. Good choice.
But when we think about how we walk around, right, we're confident walking on a piece of cement because we've walked on so many pieces of cement before that we just expect that it's going to work well. You know, you consider a tourist exhibit.
Cement
where you hang
feels
out
like
over.
A natural thing, as
feels
opposed
like a natural
to
thing,
yeah,
right?
As opposed to
and,
a design.
And you know, you talk about the ivory tower, and I think that as scientists, we sit in an ivory tower that's been built by people who found very practical uses for the stuff that we do.
Oh, okay. Say that again in a different way.
As scientists, yeah. We sit in an ivory tower that's been built by people who we've given ideas to, and given technology to, and given materials to. The artist who looks at how glass flows when they're making a pipe or a window. I don't know why I started there, but anyway.
glass is really good material.
But it's a viscous material, right? And coming from chemical engineering, you can wrap equations around why this is doing what it's doing.
Yeah.
But the artist just sees it. They know it. They don't need the mathematics.
Right. But they understand they see the science non-Newtonian in a different fluid way. Without the equations.
Yeah.
The qualitative understanding. It's very, very important, and the best example I can think of, and this is why the reason I'm wearing a suit, Charlie, is I have to introduce an astronaut to present the astronaut scholar. The best description of that was by Sandy Magnus.
I would like a T-shirt that says, I have to introduce an astronaut.
That's why I'm wearing a suit.
I want that to be an album.
But it's Sandy Magnus gave a really good description on our radio show, Inside the Black Box, Wednesdays at noon on WREK Atlanta.
91.1.
I can do the same thing. She
Tony,
said,
you're going to plug your radio show, right?
When you're on the International Space Station for 3 to 6 months.
Fast times at Georgia Tech.
You know,
Tech.
And you cut your hair short, but they give you this dry shampoo. It just doesn't work.
What?
After a while.
I'm sorry. You know what? I was making a radio joke,
right.
A Fast Times at Ridgemont High reference, and I missed how you got from astronaut to shampoo.
Well, because if you're on the space station for 3 to 6 months, you eventually have to wash your hair. Most of the guys shave their heads. Now, Sandy Magnus, being
so
a woman.
So you and I are one step closer to astronauthood.
Yes, we are basically in the slot for the astronaut program.
If I could except do for the fact that we were worth the sex of crap. I could be an astronaut.
So she illustrated how you wash your hair in space with water, and basically the lesson was surface tension is your friend. Surface tension mathematically is very hard to explain, but qualitatively she did an excellent job doing it. And I'll tell you, you want to see the best – I realize I should do this as a field trip now. Your best introduction to modern material science, go to Home Depot. The stuff they have on the shelves is – it's different than what it was 5 or 10 years ago.
Do you build stuff, Tony?
I make things. I make a lot of things.
What do you make?
Whatever I want to see that I haven't seen before.
And does that turn into like – are we talking about sort of high level functioning or like a chair?
Drawings.
Or?
It'll be a sculpture out of a piece of cardboard or watercolor paper. I'll take little toys and just kind of make weird hybrids of those. But
so you're equally artist and scientist.
Yeah, I mean, what I think what's kind of unifying about it is that down to the core, I make stuff.
Yeah,
and I put a lot of effort into making stuff. I try to make sure that I put a lot of myself into it. Because it's a really healthy gauge when I look at it on the end. If I put everything into it, then I have sort of a healthy third-person perspective of myself, at least in a sort of compartmentalized way. And if I can learn that with different mediums from an artistic standpoint, then moving over into science and realizing that one code base or one piece of information or one experimental piece of equipment, all it is a new tool that I have access to. Mm-hmm. And learning the different ways of representing and explaining how that sort of feels, I think, is a really critical element in being a scientist and being able to explain it to a diverse number of people, because you never know who can really help you.
And that sounds just like the surface tension example that Pete was talking about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So why aren't more people like you? Just to make this weird.
There's a big problem with the brain drain. I mean, the academic brain drain, it's real. I mean, it's not a very glamorous job. I really, really enjoy the freedom, but what I enjoy the most is access to things that people have never seen before. I think I'm kind of selfish about that, you know.
So what are the things people haven't seen before?
So a microscope image, take this picture of this small realization of the world. You know, it might be a couple thousand atoms big, or it might be a tenth of a millimeter big, but it's something that most of the popular world has never seen or appreciated before. And it's such a beautiful process to me and product, because there's a lot of expertise and there's a lot of skill of a craftsman, of a microscopist or somebody that I don't really have that ability.
The best experimentalists are artists.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it.
Yes. And what's unfortunate about it is that we kind of go past, as scientists, we go past the step of art and we objectify it right away. We don't really necessarily appreciate the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. But like when you consider how much money and how much time and how much effort has gone into making these images, mm-hmm. and then we just want to get numbers out of them. But just if you stop at the images, I mean, there's something of intrinsic good and intrinsic value there. There's a deep process and there's a lot of understanding and education that goes into that.
Well, will that help more with the education and the STEM outreach and things like that? When you can show them that image and they say, wow, and then you explain why the science is important, how it will impact you. Even if it may not impact you for 10 years, this is where I want to defend the fundamental science people. It doesn't always have application in your regular life, and it may take a while, but we build upon these tiny little bits of arcane science that 20 years later make a difference.
Which is better, though?
Well, do they make a difference? That's a big assumption right now.
Some of them do, but we never know which ones will, because I am no oracle, so I'm willing to do anything that seems reasonable.
Well, I think, again, offline or before we started chatting, you mentioned that these little arcane things eventually become something. And one of the things that I mentioned is that I feel like we're adding a lot of precision to randomness, mm-hmm. and a lot of
precision to randomness.
Yeah, precision to randomness. So so what I mean by that is that there are these ideas that have somehow survived, right? Mm-hmm. They've created these little aberrations in our world of knowledge. And people kept pushing after them. And then we built structure and ideas around them. And now we're sitting here in this little very smooth point of the world. And whatever I think a lot of the interesting solutions and problem sets really sit are in between these little arms in these little precise regions.
So do you have a couple examples of those ideas you're talking about when you say survived?
So nanotechnology, for example. Desktop computers. I mean, all of these, you know.
Versus like alchemy and homunculi, right, which didn't survive.
Right, right. But, I mean, at the time, they were surviving and we were adding precision to them. Until we realized.
Until it came to a final dead end.
Yeah, but you know
cannot piss on lead and make gold.
There are some people at Georgia Tech that might disagree. They had this really big building set up for people to just piss off into. There's only one requirement.
If you drink this very, very particular beer, it might it's sort of an Andy Warhol brand.
But isn't that the name of the show? Consilience? Eventually, there is this unity of knowledge. There is an asymptotic limit where you realize this will work, this won't. At least in the construct of how you're doing it.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. That's never been how I've understood consilience, like the E.O. Wilson concept. Uh-huh. I always felt like what Wilson was saying was that there are truths, you know, about the world that you will come to from whatever discipline. You know, from whichever
set of tools.
And that's
just internal consistency for all the models.
Because,
you know, you can make anything fit anything, right? And this is exactly what Tony was talking about.
Is that true? That's kind of like saying all politicians are crooks, isn't it?
Well, no, but I can come up with a theory.
Can we play a game? Can we try this as a game? Is there a way to do
this? This is going to be the best
ever that's okay. Let's
right
do it.
Now.
Yeah, let's do it.
So is there a situation that we could pose to try and see if we can kind of come at this from like a weird angle and...
Well, I think as long as you're willing to limit your variables, right? So you say, I'm going to study only one variable, and even the systems on which your house is based, there's not just one variable. There's many. And you limit it to one variable. Some guy studies another variable. Some guy studies another variable. And like, look, here's the theory. No, here's the theory. Oh, this is similar to your theory, but this is different than your theory.
Well, then
you put them all together, you realize we don't know squat.
All right, so let's go ridiculous. Okay,
it sounds like it's good to have twins, right? Because you can solve two problems at once. You can do a big Monte Carlo simulation.
Set them aside,
actually,
see what's going to go on.
Bill Bennett, in the latest chapter of the book I'm reading, Is College Worth It, studied twins, and they looked at twins that went to Ivy League colleges and those that didn't.
Bill Bennett is not coming anywhere near my twins. Okay, so house, just a house, right?
Oh, okay, I thought you were talking about the series.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the William Catt.
Okay,
movie.
House. Okay,
so. I think of a house, right? And the way that I would interrogate a house, the way that I would investigate a house as a concept.
I hope this doesn't involve urinating off a tall building.
A little bit. No. And not house like my house or house like the house that I am visiting, but house, right? I'd want to find what are the compare and contrast a modern suburban house, right, with caves and with teepees. You know, I'd want to look into the apartment, the apartment, you know. Look at duplexes. I'd want to try and figure out what do people think houses represent as a purchase, as an impeccable sort of construction project. You know, they're building houses in the field where I used to do donuts and, you know, and other things. And so that's where I would start. If you said, let's all research house, that's where I'd start. Tony, where would you start?
I would probably start with houses that are really fun. Like, I'm familiar that there's a house in New York City that has a slide going down it. I'd also relate it back to a Corning video where they looked at their vision of the future and all the surfaces were glass.
A what video?
Corning.
Corning?
Corningware.
Okay.
The pottery company.
No shit.
Yeah. So they developed Gorilla Glass. That was the glass that's used in most of your cell phones. Mm-hmm. They did a futuristic look on what the modern house would look like. And they were talking about these translucent surfaces that were interactive with computers and stuff like that. So I look at the house and I try to reimagine the house as a system. But one system, right? What we have now is you have systems on top of systems where the breaking and the error, sort of error tracking of the systems is really hard to do.
What would error tracking of house system error? What would the error tracking be with a house?
I think Nest is one of the, I think Nest really provides at least a place to start right there. I mean, Nest is this integrated thermostat that's a Wi-Fi unit in the house that can be plugged in with a lot of things.
Those are getting very big.
And so Consilience to me is like this sort of non-linearity of things existing at a given time, and the ability to sort of navigate circuitous paths from one place to another. But what I think is really interesting is the prospect of the house. The prospect of the house in the future, as we can start to build these connections and make the shortest path from one idea to another much
shorter.
I'll be
damned. We literally said, "I'll look at the past and I'll look at the future."
Yeah,
Pete, what about you for house? House.
I guess being an engineer, I would look at the maintainability, right, and the fixability of these sorts of things. So
and the present. This is awesome. This is like we planned it.
it was at a World's Fair several decades ago where they actually – it might have been DuPont. It might have been somebody else. They put together a completely plastic house. And there were some really good aspects of a plastic house, right? You can clean things, right? I mean, basically, the whole thing was made out of vinyl siding. But then when they decided that the plastic house didn't work, and it might be because of, you know, other issues, sometimes aesthetics. If you don't feel right in it, I can only imagine the outgassing in a house made out of plastic. Because, you know, that outgassing in your car is called new car smell. Sits around for about 3 months. In a house, it would probably stay for 3 years.
I really don't like new car smell. There's a lot of people who love it.
Yeah. But that's the same thing with your carpet. A lot of additives in carpet, they're coming out. Some not so good, some okay, things like that. But you know what they found out? Eventually, you have to tear down a house, right? You have to tear down a part of it. You have to redo it. Mm-hmm. Materials get old. They age. You want to tear down a piece and fix it. This is why we use now wallboard instead of plaster. Plaster was this custom kind of thing. Wallboard, you can take it down in a modular fashion. They could not tear down the plastic house. You can't hit a plastic because it was flexible plastic.
Yeah.
It was plasticized. You hit it with a wrecking ball and it just goes boing. And I think they just like...
So you'd have to
cut it with a scissors.
Yeah, you'd have big magnifying glass.
Yeah, and they melted the whole thing or something. So there's the maintainability.
Life size Barbie and Ken dolls,
and
then
now that
set
you have
fire
a house, man, you will learn. And I learned this from plumbers. Right? To me, people say, "Oh, I've never met a scientist or engineer." That's a load of crap. You met a plumber, an HVAC guy, an electrician. These are the scientists and engineers that interface with the world.
You know, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance that made that clear to me.
Yeah, and I was sitting in Home Depot. We've talked about this on the podcast before.
Chicken wire.
And I was what was I trying to do? I was getting
compost
some copper
bin,
pipe,
PVC
and
pipe.
Some zinc alloy solder to sweat the pipes. And I realized that's easy when the house doesn't have wallboard in it. But when you put the house together and you're in this confined space, you almost set the house on fire. That almost happened to me because you get your torch in there. It's ugly. But that was a good material system. It was very reliable. But now my house is springing leaks, and now there's this nice composite gasket material where you can just jam this connector on real easy. It's called a shark bite connector. It was made for a plastic kind of pipe called cross-linked high-density polyethylene, but you can use it on copper. And I'm like, "Oh, I need some solder." And a whole bunch of plumbers converged on me. He's like, "No, son, you don't want any solder. Try these shark bite connections. They're great." And boom, that's what I do with my house now. And who knows how long they're going to last. But I didn't set the house on fire. So I got a lesson in material science from plumbers and Home Depot, man.
So where would the three of us get, like, to finish off this little game, right? If each of us approached house from here.
Yeah, what was the game? What are the rules again? What are
we doing? So I think we're just talking about different approaches to things.
Yeah.
But you know what? The person who kind of wins or whatever would be the person who actually sat down and did something with what they knew.
Oh, look at that.
I mean, it's really when it comes down to the practical thing. We can sit here and talk about something for a really long time.
We can talk shit all day.
And you bring up Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance,
yeah.
Right? Like, there's this moment, and what we were just trying to do is we were just trying to understand what's the quality of a house,
yeah,
from our own standpoints, right? And at that moment, it is what it is. And until we make something, until we know what's actually tractable, that's when it becomes a house, right? Like, this is just an idea. You know, it's not until you get to the point that it actually becomes something or something
but
practical.
What if you implement it and people don't like it? And I want to take a house example by Buckminster Fuller. He did this bizarre cylindrical sheet metal house for building cheap houses quickly after World War II. It just looked kick-ass. You know, you can basically plunk down this cylindrical tank that's already sort of prefabbed in there, and you can build them very, very quickly. To build a house now actually takes some time.
But that tank never made it to houseness, did it?
They didn't like the tank.
So this is where scientists need help. Mm-hmm. Scientists need help, and society needs to help the scientists too, because there's a lot of crappy ideas that get to live because there's not a salesman attached to it.
How long have you had that kind of ideas living and dying sort of as a way that you understood progress and history? Did that come from somewhere? I find it really interesting.
But there are plenty of examples of this.
No, not like that it actually happened, but the way you're articulating it. You're saying, you know, these ideas live and die. And I'm like, I don't think I've heard someone talk about that before.
I think I grew up in the generation where ideas had to live and die. I was born in 83.
So it like explicitly.
Yeah, I was born in that
idea
MTV
lives or
generation.
Dies.
You know, I was born with the, you know, I mean, I watched the first airing of MTV, and yeah. I watched this really
as
awkward. So it was really ingrained
in college.
Me.
Right. Yeah, you were done already.
Yeah, I was still impressionable at the time, right. I think, and like it really.
So if you hear the Butthole
Surfers,
I love
that
You're just
and the astronaut with the flag
and
the moon.
That's the one.
It's unbelievable. Like there's, I'll listen. The happiest thing for me is to turn on the radio and hear just some 90s alternative.
Right.
Something because it's like, why the hell did they get to be there? That was the amazing thing at the time, right? They were there for no frigging reason.
You mean like the Smiths?
Hey, fuck you.
I fucking hate Morrissey. But anyway.
I think I got it on my cell phone.
No, but I mean, at the time, there were these kids dressed like idiots who didn't care, but they're having so much fun. And there is something like really pure about that awkward moment, that awkward transitioning moment before we had an ivory tower.
Right.
You know, it was a bunch of people banging down the door being like, hey, what do you think of a house? How do we build it?
Right.
And I think that sort of mentality, alongside growing up skateboarding and BMX, I realized people come, people go. And what it really comes down to with the skateboarding and the BMX is that there's a consequence for your actions.
Like gravity?
If you want to learn something, you're going to have to fall.
Wow.
And if you want to learn something you really want to learn, you're going to have to fall harder. And I think that that's a really healthy sort of experience to have when you're younger.
Yeah. Are you a scientist or an engineer?
Creative.
Cool.
It doesn't matter. It's just a pretty medium. If I get to make something that somebody has somebody feel an emotion or come up with an idea, I'm pretty happy about that. It doesn't really matter what the forum might be.
Nice.
But I think all good artists, good scientists, good engineers have attributes of all the others. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're not going to be good at it.
Mm-mm.
But I think what we're talking about here is you take the science and the engineering, and sometimes, and I was reminded this, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. I was up at an NSF meeting. I was reminded from the engineering education people that we want to make engineering education, like engineering, as objective as possible.
Assholes.
Doesn't work that way. No. And they were arguing against it. So to NSF's credit, they were saying, this is what we try to do, but it's ridiculous. It's all implemented and understood in a human context. You cannot take that out of the equation.
So why is that your reaction?
So what the generation preceding this one has worked really hard to provide structure. And
you're saying the generation before millennials? I don't really know.
Somewhere where somebody went wrong at some point or another. I'm not going to pinpoint it, but
it's Pete.
You probably got to blame the baby boomers. I'm at the cusp of baby boomers and Gen X.
So the generation
before this one.
I mean, there's this idea that there is a good, that there is a singular notion of this. And you look at all of this general policy and stuff going on, and everybody's happy, everybody's sad. It's like the internet. I don't know why politics are trying to be a software company right now, but it's ridiculous to me. But when you look at these isolated things that can happen when a dozen people get together and work on a focused effort and do something, they can change the world in 2 days. The policy takes 2 years to talk about how it's going to change the world, and then a couple years before they actually realize that it doesn't fucking work. I really think that there is a value in appreciating the local and regional and cultural contributions that organizations can make.
Yeah.
Georgia Tech has one skill. MIT has other skills. Stanford has other skills. And, I mean, it's really a matter of understanding and appreciating where your skills actually sit and doing something with them, not trying to game what other people are trying to do and beat them at them.
I am in a terrible position now because of the tension between the 12 people working on a single project versus the resources and freedom that a large institution gives those 12 people, in the sense that I am an academic librarian at the Georgia Institute of Technology, right? I'm recording a podcast right now on work time, right? Because I'm doing it with one of my liaison constituents, right? The director for the Center for Academic Enrichment. with a GTRI research...
Georgia Tech.
You're not GTRI? No. I'm sorry. I've been confusing people with other people recently because I've been distracted. What with the incoming.
Twins on the way.
So yeah, you're a Georgia Tech scientist, right? This all works for me, right? This is my work and this is what I do, mm-hmm. you know? And part of the reason I have this freedom, I do a radio show, I do a podcast.
What the hell do you do to contribute to society?
I am able to sit down with some of my colleagues and say, we need to write a paper about what virtual browsing is. And by the end of the meeting, we're like, we need to talk about what research is in the digital culture, you know? So we're going to write a paper just really for ourselves. It's essentially a narrative of what it might be in 10 years. Like, how do you preserve and make accessible culture and knowledge that's being created in a digital world that's different from, you know, the card catalog? It used to be you write books, now you can do most anything. So what do we do with that most anything? The reason I have that freedom, though, to just find who I want to work with and just do it, is because Georgia Tech is huge and the library is amorphous and I just get to do whatever I want.
Except, I don't think you get to do whatever you want.
I was about to say, except I kind of don't. There's these blocks. So, but then there's, you know, in the room that I have cleared out for myself, I have this immense freedom. But then the walls are kind of tight. So I don't know. There's a lot of money at my disposal in the sense of this radio station. We are sitting in WRAK right now. It could, for up to 3-4 months, just broadcast a sound and explain that, you know, we're doing some kind of noise project, and we could get away with that, you know, because it's not beholden to shareholders, not beholden to a contract, it's not beholden to a commercial advertiser or anything like that. And I feel a certain joy with that, but then it's also part of Georgia Tech, which is a monolithic entity.
Isn't that consilience in some way? I mean, when you think about it, what you just described is you described the emergence of your position at this institution. The complex balance that you have to deal with in order for you to make this a job that makes you happy. And a job that makes you a contributor to it. I mean, there's a good and a bad with it. And understanding those complex relationships kind of makes it easy to appreciate, right?
That was awesome. You're like a therapist. I am a system of tubes with pneumatic
pressure. I think
you're going to
get us all fired with that kind of ranting that you do.
Oh, is this too hippie?
No. But what you do is not just ramble on. I mean, the purpose of consilience is to explore the interface between science and humanities. That's extremely important to Georgia Tech.
Well, let's not confuse the concept of consilience that Tony was just talking about and then our podcast called Consilience.
I'm just moving into the idea of the general emergence that Wilson presents in consilience, I think, is really the central feature of his work.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I believe that things ebb and flow, is because I understand that it is a very non-linear and unpredictable thing.
My professional life is a series of experiments that I'm finding the results for.
And some give very interesting positive results, some are total failures, but you learn as much from the failures.
But a failed experiment is as important, perhaps even more important than
but
a successful
that
experiment.
That is the nature of what academics do. They
explore, or the experimental testing of a failed hypothesis.
Yeah, they explore what the future will be. Sometimes we make a hypothesis that's total crap and we realize that's not going to work. Sometimes it didn't work and then it works differently or better under other contexts. Sometimes the cylindrical house, you're not ready for it. Maybe we're ready for it now. Who knows?
Oh, God, no. Would you live in a cylinder house?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, you could put a slide down the side of it. Yeah, that would be fun.
So let me give it a good example.
So it would look like a giant screw head. Yeah.
Architecture, engineering, and economics coming together. It's called the Quaker Hilton. I believe it's in downtown Akron. When I visit the University of Akron, I stayed in there a couple of times.
All the words you just used, it's like they don't go together.
But they built a hotel. Because think about it. Things cost money. For you to find a way to do something cool without spending a lot of money is a good thing.
I have found that it's not true that things cost money. Things just come to me. I make requests and they arrive.
But if you're going to build a hotel. Yeah, sometimes you're paid what you're worth. It's clear. You got to build a hotel, right? Because people got to stay someplace when they visit the university.
So you're playing Monopoly.
There's an old grain silo that's no longer used. Ironically, it was used for Quaker Oats. Four big cylindrical towers that kind of fits the size of a decent hotel room. And then you've got a central elevator section, which is literally the elevator lobby for the hotel. And they just walled it off and put in floors and built this really neat hotel out of it. And your room is round. I thought it was really cool. I mean, they put windows in it. It's really neat, but it's made out of an old grain silo.
And it's an acronym.
And it smells like oatmeal. You're in there, you're like, what the hell is that? It smells like oatmeal.
No, just putting syrup on the floors.
Yeah, it was just, it was a nice hotel and probably reasonably priced because someone didn't have to build all that concrete. Why let it go to waste? To me, that's an interesting
How
redesign.
How long have you been holding on to that?
I love that hotel. I'd stay there again.
So you mentioned earlier about the person who has to drive 2 hours. Go 2 hours to New York City.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There, what was it?
Bedroom community.
Bedroom mm-hmm. community. This, I'm going to go real far and hopefully try and bring this back in, but it's insane to me all the new construction that's going on in these cities.
Yeah.
It's elevating prices and it's pushing the workers out of the cities who actually make the city work. Mm-hmm. But then you have a lot of entitled people living within the city who don't want to get their hands dirty, who don't want to chop wood for 6 hours of fire, you know? And it seems insane to be building a lot of new things when you could do something like retrofit.
To me, that's art to merge those things together. It's pretty cool.
Well, I personally, so I live over in Cabbage Town, and I live mm-hmm. in an old dry ice factory.
Oh, cool.
Like, it was an old building.
Yeah, which loft is that?
It's a Reynolds Town Square.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but it's really, that whole area used to be super industrial. And mm-hmm. it still kind of is.
Yeah, what is it? Mattress factory lofts mm-hmm. and the
Stacks.
Fulton Mill.
And then you have the Ford lofts and stuff. But Atlanta, I think, does a really great job retrofitting the buildings around here.
Yeah, but it's like an arm wrestling match between post apartments and that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, the new areas, the Inman Park areas, they're starting to fill out. And they're becoming a little bit more New York, San Francisco kind of.
Yeah, they knocked down neutral. Dad's garage to build a...
But you go outside of, you go 3 miles in the other direction, and there are just these big box stores that are completely empty with people work, except for maybe one store, with somebody working the saddest job in the world. Yeah. And it just raises the question, what can you do with that?
I saw a gorgeous picture of a Walmart building that had been turned into a library.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was really
awesome.
Cool. And there's something there, like where the... You know, if we have to have collections of books, right, that and the rent's too high to have a big, huge collection of books on Ponce, say, which is why the Ponce, the Leon branch of the Fulton...
County Library?
The Atlanta Fulton Public Library System is so small. It's just, it's about as big as the bank across the street, you know? But you could go to Loganville, and you could find a dead Kmart, and you could have a massive library. Mm-hmm. If you build a... fucking train from the center of town to there, then you would have this huge library and you could read your book and finish it on the way up, return it, and then read your new book on the way back down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess that's a little too hippie.
Nobody wants
trains.
I think that a lot of there's so many interesting things going on across the country, and you can tell it because people are pissed off. You're pissing people off. Young people are pissing old people off, and that's great. From a great height, because, I mean, the countries that think that they can control Twitter. Like, get out of here. You can't control the internet. It's a really powerful tool, but there's a lot of responsibility in using it appropriately. And I think that Atlanta and kind of the way that people have been able to self-organize and beautify this city is one of its, like, real charms. I mean, there's still a very community and neighborhood element to this, and I don't think that what you're suggesting is really out of line. I mean, you see people from the city moving out to farms now because mm-hmm. it's accessible. And those same people are building murals in the city because they want to be here.
Yeah, I bet you there's a high attrition rate of those moving out of the city for a farm, folks. Mm-hmm. Not because – and this is nothing about someone's character, but I just – I have thought about moving to a farm because it seems very simple and it seems like it would be quite pleasurable. But chopping the wood reminded me that I am soft – and it is tough.
See, your ambitions are too small, Charlie. And I understand you got two kids to worry about. But the farm that I'm envisioning has all the heavy lifting equipment that I've ever wanted in one place.
You've built the robots and they will do everything.
No robots. I'm taking those big yellow trucks and I'm smashing everything. So I'm just going to decimate your little pieces of wood. Think bigger.
We tear the trees up from their roots, snap them in half.
I'll get a trebuchet there and I'll call it Charlie. You can just shoot whatever the hell you want as far
Please
as you
do.
Can.
I would like to be the name of a catapult for sure. Pete, what do you got, man, after all this?
My brain hurts.
Why?
The problem is this idea of, you know, people who aren't necessarily experts in science engineering redesigning their world. That's very, very important. And we've talked about the citizen
Minecraft.
Science movement, the do-it-yourself movement. These are all good things. There is contribution that can come from the public if science and engineering shares that with them, if we beef up that interface. Mm-hmm. But very few people share this view. People just want to go lockstep and vote for the same people. Oh, we'll do this. Very rarely do you see people reaching out. And the best example I can think of recently was in Cabbage Town. What's the tunnel there?
Krog
Tunnel.
The Krog Tunnel. A good friend of mine who's a comedian did a whole one-man show on the Krog Tunnel in the history. It was absolutely amazing. I want to share that with my students sometime.
He did it in the tunnel or he did it
No, he didn't
the
do it in the tunnel. Yeah. He actually did it as part of the Atlanta Fringe Festival.
Just sat in the middle choking on exhaust.
And he showed a lot of slides of the art and the evolution thereof. But I heard some rich guy wanted to block that whole thing off for a party.
No, they did.
They did.
Yeah. And then, but what did the artists do? They snuck in there, painted the whole thing gray.
Let Tony tell it. Tony knows.
Okay, so this was actually a community movement.
Yeah, I love this.
So this guy, so the gentleman who had organized the event.
That was very polite of you.
So Krog Tunnel. Krog Tunnel is probably one of the more prolific graffiti galleries in the city, I would say.
Yeah. It is a canvas for humanity.
It's been running for about 20 years or so.
Yeah.
And
it is literally a driving and pedestrian tunnel. This is not a joke. Krog Tunnel is a tunnel underneath the MARTA tracks.
If Krog Tunnel doesn't exist, it takes me 10 minutes longer to get to where I need to go, or 15 minutes longer on bicycle. Yeah. Not by car. So they closed this off, and what the neighborhood had done was the day before they had or the day before the event, the whole community chipped in and bought a bunch of primer, and they whitewashed the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it was when I originally interpreted it, it seemed as if they were just doing it to upset the organizers, but there's been a lot of uprising within the art community in Atlanta about public art spaces. And what it really was is they didn't want somebody coming into the city and making money off of art that we do
that
for
they
free
created
for everybody
to
else.
Share. Absolutely. Yes. What didn't they put a hashtag on there?
Like, Krog's not for sale, I believe it was. But after they buffed it, everybody went over and just did the shittiest graffiti job over the primer, and it looked absolutely awful. Cabbage Town did an amazing job at making this a fair, as laughable as it was. But when he was coming through and sort of championing his cause, I mean, there was no give back to the city. Mm-hmm. But he was also saying that we've done this in Paris and San Francisco and L.A. and New York. But I really think that argument might work in other places, but I don't think around Atlanta people want to be that. Mm-hmm. Atlanta just wants to be what it is, and that's kind of its charm.
It's amazing, too, that from a distance, the Krog masquerade does look like a very
artsy, like, inclusive
It looks
thing.
Like an indie event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is a straight up, it's a Buckhead development event. It's tourism in a way, right?
It's tourism for people who are too afraid to go into the gentrified areas of the city.
Now, let's give Buckhead its due. I am terrified of going into Buckhead.
You're afraid someone's going to give you a brochure for a pedicure.
I think that there might be white guys in shorts with belts at any moment coming packs. To talk to me. And no, that it's Buckhead, I think, is very
asking you about your stocks. You just walk around with your head hanging down, and somebody's like, "Have you invested today? Did you check your stocks?"
What, wondering if I might want some sushi. That's stupid. I love sushi. I don't know why I did that. But yeah, I mean, like, there's a tremendous. It's only what, 6 miles between, say, the heart of Buckhead and Krog Tunnel. Yeah, maybe seven, mm-hmm. and it is like 50,
night and day.
50 years.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It's you need to cross this boundary.
It's but so Buckhead. Buckhead's kind of upsetting. Buckhead. It's from afar. It's very, the buildings look prominent and they look pretty, but
it's the downtown that we already have.
Well, it's anesthetized in some way. It's really neutral. It sort of caters to the mean in some way or another. And one of the more recent Wired articles presents an interesting discussion, because what we have access to is we have access to being capable to do just about anything now. If you want to make something, if you want to build something.
You mean people in general?
In general. You mm-hmm. can go online and you can find out how to do it. But now that general ideas and the fundamental equipment has become so accessible and so available and so easy to do, everything looks the same now. So if we've designed our rules for everything to look nice, and everything looks nice now, but everything looks the same, the question is what's going to set it apart now? Where's the grit? Where's the aberrations that seem like controlled mistakes?
Have you got a guess?
Huh? I think that that's what sets work apart. I think that finding the charm, finding that little piece that makes something it is what it is, not something it isn't. You know, I mean, you could often I think that you want people to say this is like this tool, but you always want that little but part. But it's harder to find where those opportunities exist now. Also,
those little niches, and of course, once you find them, a bunch of people paint it gray.
Yeah.
Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
What happened to the unity of knowledge, dude?
That's at the beginning. This is at the end.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for listening to Consilience with Pete and Charlie. You can find us on Facebook. You can like our page, share our episode announcements. Follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Tumblr, too. Pete and Charlie, we're all over the internet.
And what is the Georgia Institute of Technology and WRIK Atlanta think of the content of Consilience?
Hopefully, they'll never find out.